What's up, everybody? Welcome to episode number 89 of the Moderate Podcast for Sunday, August 30th, 2020. Glad to have you with us this week. And I think I probably sound a little bit better than I did last week. Last week, I recorded this show really late. I actually even got comments about how the show sounded. And admittedly, it was not my best work because I was extremely tired. I was doing it around midnight on Sunday night, and so that was part of the explanation. It was just a really long and arduous weekend and full of things. So obviously I was not on top of my game, and also because when I'm recording late at night, everyone else in the house is asleep. I want to make sure that I keep the volume to a minimum in order to make sure that people can sleep in this house while I'm trying to record the video. Well, everyone's awake right now, so you may hear occasional background noise, and so that's just part of the deal, right? Because I record at my house. This is a low-budget program, no doubt about it, but hopefully this week will be much better, more coherent, and I sound a little more, there's a little more kick in my voice. Because, admittedly, not my best work, didn't sound like I was 100%. But I think I'm back at full force today to take on the various issues of the day. So let's start with the situation in Kenosha. Of course, on Monday, we all know by now that Jacob Blake, an African-American man, was shot by police. And that sparked off the media. And I'm going to kind of go into this real quick. I'm not going to go into it in detail like I did. I recorded an episode, a couple months back about, kind of in the middle of the George Floyd stuff. And I think that was, my view hasn't changed on that. This isn't any different. It continues to be a problem. It continues to be an issue. And so I'm not going to rehash that. But what I am... where I'm shifting a little bit is how the media and the Democratic Party and liberals continually talk about what's going on in Kenosha and Portland and Seattle as demonstrations, as protests, as they never once use the word riots and looting. And what was happening in Kenosha in particular is very evident that there's a lot of that going on. And one explanation I saw from somebody on Twitter that is a left-leaning person, to say the least, is that these are Trump supporters that are just agitating violence, and so they are taking and hijacking peaceful protests. And somehow this is connected to Donald Trump that's doing this. And I think what happened in Portland over the weekend is an example of why that is not the case. I think that kind of thought that this is somehow some kind of conspiracy on the behalf of Trump supporters to drum up this violence after these types of incidents happen, and I think that's on QAnon level BS. I mean I think that's a QAnon level type of conspiracy theory. It is ridiculous. What I think it is, and I actually saw this another person on Twitter say, and this makes more sense, is that it's actually maybe Bernie Sanders supporters. And that to me would make a little bit more sense than if it was Donald Trump supporters. I definitely believe that it's still a small number of people, but a small number of people can do a lot of damage. So, of course, then we hear later on in the week, this kid, the 17-year-old kid, Kyle Rittenhouse, comes from Illinois. They say he crossed state lines, and that's true. He did cross state lines. But it's, and that goes to show how much states are important in this country. So, for example, he's going to get charged for a different set of crimes, or at least a different crime, for going from his home in Illinois, in northern Illinois, into Kenosha, which is in the southeastern corner of Wisconsin. It's like on the, Kenosha County is on the border with Illinois. And so he is going to get charged with additional crimes for doing that versus, let's say this was in Springfield in the middle of Illinois, and he drove 200 miles to Springfield, much farther drive, much longer away from his home, and he wouldn't be charged with that type of crime. So it's just, it's, you know, the geography is important in that it matters that it's a different state. So anyway, that is a part of it. So people are trying to justify what Kyle Rittenhouse did. I've seen, you know, people on the right say that he's a hero, and that, you know, especially in the light of the fact that one of the people he killed turns out to be a pedophile. Now, I have no idea, but I'm pretty sure that he did not know that the guy he shot was a pedophile at the time. Pretty sure he knew, he didn't know that, okay? He's a 17-year-old. He's not a cop. He doesn't have access to this guy's record. And it's a random person. It's not like he knew the guy and shot him. So it was a random killing, in my opinion. And at the end of the day, you know, he just got lucky that it happened to be a pedophile, and people are like, you know, all of a sudden it's justified. Well, he killed a pedophile, so what's the big deal? The big deal is, number one, he didn't know he was a pedophile. Number two, he's not a cop. And even number three, cops shouldn't be indiscriminately shooting people either. Right? That's what this whole protest is about. You want to talk about law and order. Law and order is, you arrest somebody and you let them, you know, the very foundation of this country is innocent until proven guilty, and everybody gets their day in court, right? Those people didn't get their days in court. Kyle Rittenhouse saw to that. So I really have a hard time reconciling that the right is going to talk about being the party of law and order, and yet they're applauding this guy, Kyle Rittenhouse. Whether he was defending himself, whether he was, you know, in danger, and that turns out that the shooting was justified, the problem is he put himself in that situation in the first place. He didn't have to be there. It's kind of like Jacob Blake probably didn't need to get shot if he wasn't brandishing a knife and was just complying with orders. Now, I've seen videos of people shooting, you know, that's been the big argument, whether what's the whole story. And we get the story from the press about, you know, he was just trying to get into his car, from to the police saying that, no, he actually had a knife, and we weren't sure if he was trying to reach for a gun when he was in his car, going into his car, he was ignoring orders and blah, blah, blah. So there's a story of what the true cycle of events happened and whether or not the cops overreacted, right? Now, thankfully, maybe, I don't know, maybe it isn't thankful, but at least Jacob Blake is alive still. He's still alive. Now, I don't know if, you know, he's it sounds like he's paralyzed currently, and he may not recover from that. And so that's not any better, but I guess it's a little bit better than being dead. But I mean, the bottom line is that, you know, the question still remains. I'm not convinced whether it was justified or not. There's not nearly enough evidence out there. It's still all the court of public opinion. And if you're pro-police, you almost certainly believe that this was a justified shooting. If you're a BLM supporter, you're almost certain to believe that this is not a justified shooting. And it's just another example of cops abusing their power. Okay? I don't know what that is yet. None of us do. None of us do. It wasn't even 6 days ago, and we're already rushing to judgment based on our political beliefs. It has nothing to do with facts in of the matter, because the problem is, you don't, anybody listening to me right now, to my voice right now, does not have enough evidence to truly make a judgment one way or another. You don't, period. You do not have that. I don't care if you're on the left or you're on the right. You do not have enough information to truly make that call. Okay, so let's get that part straight away. So you've got that happening in Kenosha. Then Portland has had continual protests. And over the weekend, you had a MAGA rally that went into Portland. And that, now, I will say that it sounds like, for the most part, it was pretty tame. And there's videos of MAGA people. And this was one that was disturbing to me, is you've got video of MAGA people shooting pepper spray into crowds that are kind of counter-protesting, yelling at them as they drive by. You got MAGA people in trucks shooting pepper spray, shooting paintballs, okay? This video was retweeted by Donald Trump. I'm not making this up. This is what helps you. You have lost, and I retweeted this, and this was my comment. You have lost the moral authority, and I put that in quotes because that's a loose, I use the term loosely, moral authority, when I'm talking about Donald Trump. But you lose the moral authority to talk about being so offended by the riots and the looting and the criminals and being the law and order president when you have your own supporters committing crimes on video and you're retweeting that and you support that. He's not condemning it. He's saying, hey, these people have had enough. They're taking it into their own hands. If that makes it any better, that's okay. That is not okay. Come on. Come on, man. That's not okay. And it's the president of the United States doing that. So anybody that wants to defend Donald Trump, I'd really like to hear your defense of that. I'd really like to hear your defense of that. But outside of that, most of the protesting was just yelling at each other, you know, maybe blocking some traffic. There was some arrests for that. But for the most part, nobody was seriously, seriously injured until about 8:46. There was a shooting reported at 8:46 p.m. Here's the headline to the article I was reading. Man shot dead in Portland as protesters clash with counter-protesters. Okay. Now, in the article, they said that the shooting was reported at 8:46 p.m., and if you read about articles that have a detail, the timeline of all the events in Portland, you will see that the MAGA crowd actually started to disperse before that. So that's number one. Number two, the article itself with that headline says the following. It is unclear if the shooting was connected to the protests. Well, then why the hell are you making a headline that sounds like it is? Man shot dead in Portland as protesters clash with counter-protesters. What kind of crap headline is that if you're saying that it's unclear if the shooting was connected to the protests? Why are you even mentioning it then? So it's clearly a misleading headline at the very least. Because you could say, well, I was saying is that a man was shot dead and protests were going on. So that's what the headline says. But you know what that implies. You know what that implies. It implies that the man was shot dead as that was happening. The two were connected. That's a reasonable assumption to make. Any reasonable person reading that would believe that. And it wasn't until I read in the article that it was unclear if the shooting was connected to the protests. That is a problem. And that's why we're having this problem in this country. So then Adam Schiff, we're going to talk about him a couple of times in today's show. He was on Meet the Press and he covered a couple of issues he was on CNN State of the Union this morning and he covered a couple of issues, but one of the key issues that he covered was all of the violence. So here's what it said. This is from The Hill. House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff said Sunday that President Trump is, quote, willfully fanning the flames of violence amid clashes between protesters and counter-protesters over police brutality. Schiff's comments came after police said one person in Portland was fatally shot late Saturday night after clashes between a Black Lives Matter protest and a caravan of Trump supporters.
You cannot be serious!
We just went through that. We still don't know if the shooting was related to the protests, and yet they're still trying to tie the two. They're mentioning it in this article, and they're mentioning it in the context that Donald Trump is egging this on. Okay, now whether that's the case or not, that's a matter of opinion. There's no facts there. That's a matter of opinion of what the true motivation is here. Okay, Schiff added, the president is only motivated by one thing: what is in it for him. He sees this violence and his ability to agitate more of it as useful to the campaign. What it does to the country, the loss of life, he doesn't care. Okay, I mean, I could see that. I could actually see that because Trump is just such a narcissist that really all he cares about is himself and what his political prospects are. Really, it doesn't matter to him. He does not have any, I don't see anybody that's saying that he has compassion is just, you know, up in his business trying to make sure they kiss his butt to me. I think they're completely lying out of their ass if they believe that. But anyway, the bottom line is that that's still opinion, okay? Schiff said Trump simply won't act to stop violence and will try to stoke the flames on social media and through other methods because he believes the violence helps him. And I believe that's true. I believe that's true. Now, I do want to talk about, before I get to, I put together a short hypothetical speech that Joe Biden should give. And if I were a strategist for him, and obviously assuming that I believed the things he believes, and I believe in his base, so that's where it's coming from. It's not necessarily my opinions on the matter, but it's something that bakes in his opinions, but what should be said and what needs to be said. But before I get to that, I did post a chart on Twitter that has five bars on it, and it breaks it down between non-Hispanic whites, blacks, Hispanics, and other races, okay? And the five bars are percentage of population over the age of 12, percentage of violent crimes by perpetrator, by the race of the perpetrator, a percentage of violent crimes by the race of the victim, a race of victims shot and killed by police, and finally, the race of a shooter killing a police officer, okay? So, and again, these numbers don't necessarily match up, but it's about percentages, okay? So, blacks make up about 12% of the population over 12 in this country, but yet they account for about 22% of violent crimes in this country. Meanwhile, they're actually only 11% of the victims of violent crimes in this country. Whites, on the other hand, make up about 50% of violent crimes in this country, but are about 66% of the victims of violent crimes. Okay. Now, as far as police violence goes, whites, the percent of people killed by police, 40% were white. 21.5% were black. So this is where the argument comes in. It's like, well, they make up 12% of the population, and yet they're 21% of the people shot. This is data from 2018, by the way. But looking at the total population is a misnomer, because the police, who do they deal with? They tend to deal with criminals, right? You're either talking to the police because you did something wrong, or you're reporting that you did something wrong, right? Those are usually the two times that you talk to the police. You know, either you get pulled over for a traffic infraction, or you committed a crime, or you're reporting a crime, right? So they're involved with crimes. And so it's the more fair number to look at is how many violent crimes do they commit? Well, we talked about that. 22% of violent crimes were committed by blacks. And yet they were only 21.5% of the people that were shot and killed by police. Yet, police officers killed in the line of duty. Now, I will preface this by saying it's a much smaller number. It's about 1,000 people a year that get shot by police, relative, roughly speaking. Usually it's about 50 to 60 officers that get killed per year in the line of duty. So a much smaller number. So one number, one way or the other, can really skew the data. So just keep that in mind as I say that. So I'm going to preface that by saying, because I don't want to mislead people. But the perpetrator of slain police officers, 39% are white, 41% are black. So by those percentages, a police officer, when we're talking about shooting, is twice as likely to get killed than a black person is to get killed by a police officer when you're talking about their percentages. Now, again, the numbers are really skewed off. So it's really kind of, it's not a fair assessment to make necessarily. That's why I think violent crimes, because obviously the more the higher the number of violent crimes you're involved with, the more involved you're going to be with police, correct? And so if there were true racism in the police force on a global, on a national level, you would expect that the percentage of people killed by the police would be much higher than the percentage of perpetrators in that same race, if race were the case, were the issue. It's in the other category that it's really, there's a big discrepancy, and that's mostly has to do with Native Americans. So if anybody should be pissed, and Native Americans have plenty of reason to be pissed in this country, this is another reason they should be pissed, because they're disproportionately killed, you know, relative to their percentage of violent crime. So they commit 14% of the crime, not Native Americans, all other races besides non-white, non-Hispanic whites, blacks and Hispanics. Okay, so that's everybody else. And again, it's 14% are the perpetrators, but yet about 23% of victims of police shootings are in that other category. So a much higher number. If we're talking about racism, that's what I would more see, would likely see. But the fact that those percentages are so close, because the more violence you commit, the more interactions you're going to have with police, and the more likely you're going to be killed by the police, because it's just a law of averages, right? So that to me doesn't tell me that there's violence or that there's racism in the police department. That's what people don't understand, and that's what they're not following. So that's a very, very important statistic to keep in mind in all these arguments, okay? It doesn't mean that racism doesn't exist, but what it does mean is that it's not necessarily systemic. It means that these incidents we're looking at are truly isolated incidents, and we're just focusing on one incident but not on others, because whites still are more likely to be killed by police based on total numbers than blacks, because they're at about 40%. So they're twice as likely to be killed. Just there's twice as number of people, white people, that have been killed by police officers than black people. So that's just, another thing to keep in mind. And there is a discrepancy, though, between the number of violent crimes that white people are involved in and the number of times they're shot by police. So again, the real gripe to me when you're looking at that data, that statistic, is probably in the Native American population, not in the African American community, on that particular piece of it, okay? Again, that doesn't mean that black people don't have their own experiences and they don't get pulled over by the police much more often for no reason at all. You know, DWB, driving while black. I have lots of friends, African American friends, that have talked about their personal experiences with it. Obviously, they're alive today. They comply. They listen. But it doesn't mean that they're not pissed that they're getting pulled over more than another person just because of the color of their skin. They are looked at differently by the police than they look at white people. That's fact. And there's enough, while it's anecdotal, you can only go so far in the anecdotal evidence before you go, okay, there's a pattern here. And I know plenty of people that have had this exact experience. They're really good people, solid people, not criminals whatsoever, do not commit crimes, but yet they've been pulled over multiple times by the police for no apparent reason and been asked to get out of the car for no apparent reason. So it does happen. Let's not pretend it doesn't happen. And let's not pretend that we need to try to maybe fix all the issues as to why that is, all of them, including the fact that blacks commit a disproportionate amount of the crimes. We need to get to the bottom of that. We need to get to the bottom of why they are disproportionately economically challenged, and why they're causing a disproportionate amount of crime. We need to solve those issues. And I've gone over this before, and I don't want to go down that road again because I've already talked about it in this show. But that is the problem we have to solve. It's not the relationship between the police force and the black community. It has to do with the underlying problems within those communities that may or may not be caused by what's going on in those communities and what makes police have to react to that. Okay, let's solve the real issue. So what I've done here is I have a Biden speech that I've wrote to address the Kenosha issue. And again, this is from Biden's point of view, Biden's political philosophy that I don't necessarily agree with. So just keep that in mind. So this is as if somebody, a speechwriter, wrote it for Biden, but something that needs to be said in order to take a huge weapon away, because part of this is playing to Donald Trump's hand. And I think that is what's pushing the polls more than anything, is these type of things and the Democrats' silence on the fact that there is rioting, there is looting going on, and that they're not even acknowledging it. So that is what the context of the speech is. So here is my speech that I would tell Joe Biden to give. My fellow Americans, in Kenosha, Wisconsin, Jacob Blake became another in an unacceptably long line of African Americans shot by police. And it reminds us that we still have a long way to go to end police violence against our Black brothers and sisters. It stirs up many emotions. Anger. People are angry that this kind of thing keeps happening, and I join you in that anger. Fear. Fear in our African American community that they will be the next victim. And we are seeing demonstrations all over our country that show that people have had enough. And not just in the Black community. A diverse group of people have come together to say that this has to stop. But among those peaceful demonstrators are a small amount of people that have taken their anger to a whole other level, quite frankly, an unacceptable level. Again, while the anger is understood, we need to remember that protesting and what the protesting and demonstrations are all about. They are not only to tell the world about your anger, but also to come together to make the changes necessary to solve these issues once and for all. Looting and rioting are not a way to bring people together. Getting in people's faces and threatening them Looting and rioting are not a way to bring people together. Getting in people's faces and threatening them if they do not agree with you does nothing to convince them to join you. These things just add to an already complex problem. People are skeptical. People that are skeptical or on the fence about this issue will not be persuaded by this behavior. And while I understand it is a relatively small few, we can no longer ignore the negative impact that this behavior has on this movement. How can we reduce violence by actively participating in it? As Michelle Obama has said, when they go low, we go high. This advice is now more important than ever. When we condemn police violence, we also need to condemn the types of demonstrations that are detrimental to the Black Lives Matter movement. I urge everyone to stand up for what you believe in and use your First Amendment rights to voice it. But let's do it the right way. Our opponents only gain strength when violence and destruction are used to voice our frustration. We need to stop it, and we need to stop it within. Stop the violence. Stop the destruction. It has no place in this movement. Thank you, and may God bless the family of Jacob Blake, and may God bless all of you, and may God bless America. So that's the speech that I think Biden should give, and I think it would move a lot of people in the middle. It would make it would show that, hey, we recognize that we're not perfect either. But everyone is so apt to just want to point the finger, you know, like Adam Schiff wants to point the finger and saying that somehow Donald Trump is causing all the rioting and looting. And he's right that it helps him. He's absolutely correct in that. But it's not up to Donald Trump to then turn around and stop it. It's up to you guys to acknowledge that this is happening and that it's your guys that are doing it and that you need to tell them to knock it off. Because then they won't have any footing to say that you're doing nothing about it. Because right now, they have that ability to say that. And it is helping them in the polls. So if that's what you want to do and this is the hill you want to die on, you're going to die on that hill. And you're going to get Donald Trump again for 4 more years. So you guys better get your crap together if you guys really want to beat him. Because the way you're going about it right now, you are not bringing anybody that wasn't already on your side to your side. You're alienating more people than you need to. It's another unforced error by the Democrats. They listen so loudly to their base that they're not going to lose, by the way, to crap on everyone else. And Donald Trump to his credit, does the same thing. Like, nobody wants, does anybody want people like me to vote for them? Does anybody even, like, have any desire to get to people that are reasonable, moderates, on their side? Because there's a big number of us out here that need a home, that we need a political home, and none of you want us. None of you want us. It's ridiculous. You have your bases already. Use these next 65 days to win us over. Because we are the ones that you need to win it, not your base. So stop placating to them. Stop trying to just satisfy that 10% that you've got in your pocket no matter what. Stop doing that. And get over here in the real world. That's what's going to get you elected. But if you go by the same playbook, you think Donald Trump was a fluke? He wasn't. And if you're playing the same playbook as you did 4 years ago, Don't be surprised when you get the same result. All right. When we come back, I'm going to talk about the election intelligence. Then we're going to get into the RNC and DNC speeches. I'm just going to talk about the acceptance speeches for Biden and Trump. And then we're also going to talk about Big Brother. And I'm going to give you my prediction on what I think is going to happen based on what I know today. I'm going to give you my prediction as to who is going to win this election. All right, so that's all coming up when we come back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Moderate Podcast, episode number 89 for this Sunday, August 30th, 2020. Glad you could be with us this week. Please remember to rate and review our show on your favorite podcast catcher, if you will. We love getting that feedback, and we always want to try to be better. And I want to make sure that, you know, again, I use the tagline objective perspectives. Obviously, you know, that's a little bit of a hyperbole because it's really hard to do that. I mean, obviously, you're going to have opinions on things, and opinions on public policy, you can get sets of facts and you can be objective about those facts, but how you interpret them and how you implement policy based on those facts is where the opinion comes in. And that's where political philosophies come in. So obviously it's hard to try to be completely objective, but I think that what I try my best, I don't look at it things from just a purely left or purely right perspective. And that's what this show has been all about. So but if we're not succeeding in that, I'd certainly always am interested in to hear how we can be better. Okay, so the intelligence committee does is that they provide updates to Congress, to the intelligence committees in Congress, on various intelligence issues. So whether it's elections and other things, because they need to be in the know to be able to do their jobs properly. So I got this article from CNN, and I had to highlight what exactly I was going to say in them, because I had to skip the commentary comments in the article just to get to the facts, okay? So I'm going to give you an example of this. Here's what I intend to say. The Trump administration informed members of Congress that the intelligence chief will no longer brief them in person on intelligence security issues. That's a fact, okay? But this is what the article says in whole. The Trump administration created more fears about that possibility, the possibility of election interference, this weekend when first reported by CNN, and informed members of Congress that the intelligence chief will no longer brief them in person on election security issues. So I cut the whole opinion piece out of it and just put the facts in. So that's what I've had to kind of do to parse this article to make sure that I can kind of give you the facts of what's happening, and then I'll give you opinions from each side, and then you can kind of decide where things are at, okay? So the president's explanation for the change to election security intelligence briefing Saturday sounded benign as usual. This is the opinion part. While visiting Texas to survey the response to Hurricane Laura, he said Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe had eliminated the in-person briefings because he wanted to make sure that election security information, quote, doesn't leak, end of quote. So, of course, the Democrats had something to say in that, particularly Adam Schiff. So we're talking about him again on State of the Union on Sunday. So I guess a lot of stuff happened on that show this morning. House Intelligence Chairman Adam Schiff said it is possible the House could subpoena intelligence officials to testify on election interference. The president suggested that Schiff and others might have leaked information from previous intelligence briefings. Director Radcliffe brought information into the committee and the information leaked, Trump said, explaining the reason for the change to reporters in Texas. Whether it was Shifty Shift or someone else, they leaked the information before it gets in, and what's even worse, they leaked the wrong information and he got tired of it. So he wants to do it in a different form because you have leakers on the committee. On Fox News Sunday, Radcliffe claimed that he was cracking down on members of Congress who leak information for political purposes. We're going to do what we're supposed to do, but what we're also going to do is protect information from being leaked for political purposes. It has just happened too much, and I won't stand for it. Schiff told Bash on Sunday that Dana Bash, that neither he or anyone on his staff had leaked information, and said the president's claims about leaks amount to another lie and a false rationalization. They weren't concerned about leaks after the last briefing, or they wouldn't have come back to offer another briefing, Schiff said. What changed is, of course, the president, probably in another fit, saying, I don't want Congress informed. Because the last time that Congress was informed, the Director of National Intelligence had to put out another statement to acknowledge the fact that Russians are helping Donald Trump again. And so the context of that, of course, is earlier this month, Bill Ivanina, the top intelligence official for election security, alerted the American people in a statement that there is a high level of concern about potential foreign meddling in the election, and that China prefers an outcome where Trump is not reelected in November, while Russia is working to denigrate Biden's White House bid. And, it is what it is. So, I mean, that's true. I mean, we know that, you know, Russia's on Trump's side because they were last time. There's no reason to believe that they're not again. And he knows, and Trump and Putin knows how to influence Trump. He can play him like a fiddle. We've seen plenty of examples of that. In a show of bipartisanship at the time, I can't even say that, Florida Senator Marco Rubio and Virginia Senator Mark Warner, the top Republican and Democrat on the Intelligence Committee, released a joint statement encouraging the intelligence community to, quote, continue to make this information available, end of quote. On Saturday, they responded to the news in separate statements. Warner called the decision to stop in-person briefings as an unprecedented attempt to politicize an issue, protecting our democracy from foreign intervention that should be nonpartisan. Congressional oversight of intelligence activities now faces a historic crisis, Rubio said in his own statement. The Florida Republican went on to blame Democrats and slam the leaks. Of course, he still has to kiss Trump's butt at the end of the day. Yet this grotesque criminal misconduct does not release the intelligence community from fulfilling its legal requirements of keeping Congress informed, he said, adding that he'd spoken to Radcliffe, who said the committee will continue to receive briefings. There's no indication that means in-person briefings will resume. So there's that. And, you know, it's a long list. I mean, you see what's happening with the post office. You see what's happening with other things. And if you know that you're being attacked for not being transparent, you're not being open, why wouldn't you try to be over-transparent? Why are you trying to hide information when they already think you're doing that? The way you counter that is you be more open with it. Obviously, you don't want to compromise our intelligence community. You don't want to compromise our intelligence that we have out there, because then we might not be able to get it anymore. But if there was nothing going on, then why are you being so jumpy about this stuff? If it leaks, so what? You know what I mean? Like, why is that a bad thing? Tell me what part of national security was compromised and what endangered us by the release of that information? What was it? What was the big deal? And if it was criminal, Well, then arrest somebody. Do an investigation and arrest somebody. So I fully expect to hear that we're going to have some kind of investigation into this if some big national intelligence was compromised as a result of this leak. I'd really like to know what that is. So we'll have to see what happens with that. Okay. So the RNC and the DNC, RNC was obviously this past week, DNC was the week before that. Before I get into their speeches, we're going to fact check each of the presidential acceptance speeches. And one fact check's a little bit longer than the other, as you may imagine. Excuse me. Now, Trump on day one, like the morning of day one, was already whining about the coverage of it. Okay. Although he did end up praising CNN later, recognizing that they covered basically the entire prime time part of the convention. So he did at least recognize that. But this is what Twee said on Twitter. Incredible that CNN and MSDNC aren't covering the roll calls of states. Fake news. That's not fake news. And again, that's why when people think that he says fake news, he means they're lying. It's like, no. Fake news means they're not covering the stuff the way he wants them to cover it and the way he thinks they should cover it. It's nothing to do with facts or non-facts. So he says fake news. This is what the Republican Party is up against. Also, I'd like to hear the remarks of the delegates from individual states rather than Fox News anchors. Ridiculous. So he's going after everybody. He's whining about the coverage already. It's like, dude, grow up, man. Like, this guy whines about everything. He's supposed to be this tough guy that all these, like, MAGA, yeah, you know, Donald Trump's going to be tough on blah, blah, blah. But yet, he's always whining about something. He's such a whiny baby. It's, like, ridiculous. Anyway, you know, he says ridiculous. He's ridiculous. But, okay. So I'm going to start with, I'm just going to go in chronological order. So I'm going to start with the DNC and Biden's acceptance speech. I'm not going to cover the entire 4 days of stuff. I mean, nobody wants to hear that. But I do want to talk about the acceptance speeches for each Democratic or each nominee, because I think that is where a lot of the focus should be and a lot of information should come from. So I have this article from Roll Call that starts out, Joe Biden accepted the Democratic Party's presidential nomination with a speech that was largely accurate but lacked context in some instances. So this is one thing that he said. Just judge this president on the facts, Biden said. 5 million Americans infected by COVID-19. More than 170,000 Americans have died. By far the worst performance of any nation on earth. Biden is right. In both coronavirus cases and deaths, the U.S. has the most of any other country. But by other metrics, the U.S. does not have the worst record. When population is factored in, 7 other countries per Oxford University's Our World in Data for August 20th have more cumulative COVID-19 cases. This includes Qatar, with more than 40,000 cases per million people, in Bahrain, San Marino, Chile, Panama, Kuwait, and Peru. The U.S. places 8th with 16,706 cases per million. On deaths per capita, the U.S. also does not fare the worst. The World in Data shows America with the 10th highest death rate, better than San Marino, Belgium, Peru, Andorra, Spain, the U.K., Italy, Sweden, and Chile. In a similar data set with Johns Hopkins, the U.S. does better than an additional country, Brazil. The U.S. also does substantially better on its observed case fatality rate, or the proportion of people identified with the virus who have died. In the U.S., 3.1% of those known to be infected with the virus have died, a lower rate than 55 other countries in the Johns Hopkins analysis. Okay, so there's one place where Mr. Biden was corrected. Biden referred to the tax cuts, the GOP tax cuts championed by Donald Trump, as the president's $1.3 trillion tax giveaway to the wealthiest 1% and the biggest, most profitable corporations, some of which do not pay any tax at all. Although those with higher incomes reaped greater benefits from the tax law, most households received a tax cut. Biden's dig at the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act Biden highlighted a list of priorities, such as investing in infrastructure, education, childcare, and addressing climate change. Those are all things Biden has promised during the campaign that he could pay for, in part, by rolling back the Trump cut tax cuts on households making above the $400,000 threshold and raising the corporate tax from 21% to 28%. And that's going to be addressed in Trump's speech later. The line harkened back to one Biden used in his campaign kickoff speech on April 29th, 2019, when he claimed that all of the tax cuts signed into law by Trump went to folks at the top and corporations that pay no taxes. The Tax Policy Center estimated that about 65% of households paid less in federal income tax in 2018 under the tax law than they would have paid under the old tax laws, while about 6% paid more. 82% of middle income earners, those that with incomes between $49,000 and $86,000, received a tax cut that averaged about $1,050 in 2018. Most of the individual income tax provisions expire after 2025, though, which will then shift most of the tax benefits to the top 1%. So right now, about the 1% of income earners got about 20.5% of tax cut benefits in 2018. That percentage would go up to 25.3% in 2025 and then jump to 82.8% in 2027. Right after Trump would be termed out. Interesting timing. Biden took aim at Trump by arguing that, quote, our seniors, Social Security is a sacred, that for our seniors, Social Security is a sacred obligation, a sacred promise made, and that the current president is threatening to break that promise, end of quote. He's proposing to eliminate a tax that pays for almost half the Social Security without any way of making up for that lost revenue resulting in cuts. Biden's comments refer to statements made by Trump by this month suggesting that he wants to permanently eliminate the payroll tax funds, that payroll tax that funds Social Security. Trump administration officials, on the other hand, have said that the president was referring to the permanent forgiveness of a recently announced payroll tax deferral, and we talked about that on the show last week. In remarks on August 8th, Trump said, if I'm victorious on November 3rd, I plan to forgive these taxes and make permanent cuts to the payroll tax. I'm also going to make them all permanent. Now, how he's going to do that, I don't know, because he doesn't have the power to do that. 2 days later, he said, I signed directives to give a payroll tax holiday with the understanding that after the election, on the assumption that it would be victorious for an administration that's done a great job, we will be ending that tax. We will be terminating that tax. Again, what he means is that you're not going to owe that next year. But again, he doesn't have the power to do that. Congress only has the power to do that. He can change the way we collect it, but he can't change the fact that they owe the money. So the only way that's going to happen is if Congress agrees to it. So how he's going to end up doing that, I don't know. Biden would have a point about Trump threatening Social Security if the president indeed plans on terminating a tax that funds the program. But it's not clear what Trump would do, and his aides say he was referring only to making a short-term tax deferral permanent, which has less of an impact on Social Security's finances. So in other words, again, he's making that deferral permanent that you're never going to owe that money. But he's not saying eliminate the tax altogether. Okay, so Trump is not a very good communicator, so I can see where the confusion comes, but I will give him the benefit of the doubt on that one. Biden went through some of the economic impacts of the coronavirus pandemic, saying more than 10 million people are going to lose their health insurance this year. That figure comes from an Urban Institute study, though it's worth noting the study said most of those 10 million would regain insurance from another source. The Urban Institute estimated the impact from job losses on those with employer-sponsored health insurance, finding that over the April to December timeframe, 10.1 million people would lose their employer-sponsored coverage. But many would switch their insurance through another family member, Medicaid, or the individual market, leaving about 3.5 million in uninsured in the end. And that's about it. So those are some of the key highlights of some of the things that Trump or that Biden said in his speech about Trump that weren't necessarily true. Now, we're going to go through Trump's speech. This is going to take a little bit longer, so bear with me. All right. Let's start with this one. We developed from scratch the largest and most advanced testing system in the world. America has tested more than every country in Europe put together and more than every nation in the Western Hemisphere combined. We have conducted 40 million more tests than the next closest nation. The U.S. has also developed a wide array of effective treatments, including a powerful antibody treatment known as convalescent plasma that will save thousands of lives. Thanks to advances that we have pioneered, the fatality rate has been reduced by 80% since April. So here is some background on that. Trump's own CDC director, Dr. Robert Redfield, admits the U.S. has missed 90% of coronavirus cases with its testing efforts. On June 25th, he told reporters that the CDC had estimated there were many more cases than testing had detected. A good rough estimate now is 10 to 1, Redfield told a media briefing. Well, wait a minute. So you're telling me that we don't have 5 million cases. We have about 50 million cases. If that's the case, then we probably have pretty much reached herd immunity. And that means that the virus is far less deadly than what's being reported. It really is a bad flu season at that point. It's a flu season. It's a bad one. But it's not significantly worse than that. Now, there are some people that say, hey, look, on the other hand, the recovery, I mean, the whole reason we didn't do even worse is because some of the lockdowns and some of the measures we took, even with all those measures, we're still at 180,000 deaths. It's a fair point. It would be different if we hadn't taken those measures. Or would it? I mean, we don't know. I mean, we can assume that's the case, but it'd be really, it's even trying to figure that out is difficult. I guess you could look at a place like New York City versus California, where we were more proactive in our closings before it's really started getting spread here, whereas the shutdowns in New York happened, you know, far too late. And so would that have happened in California had we done nothing? I don't know. There's models that say that that's the case, but it's really you can manipulate that. I mean, I'm not saying that they are being manipulated, but it is very possible that it could be, and that's a problem. This article goes on to talk about convalescent plasma. It is a 100-year-old last-ditch treatment, and the FDA commissioner acknowledged he overstated its potential benefits on Sunday. So, you know, he touts that, but is it really a big thing? We talked about the deaths already, and you know they also go into that. We've talked about the countries that are doing worse than us. You know, Brazil, Sweden, UK, more than 100 countries have lower death rates than the US: Mexico, Panama, France, Netherlands, Switzerland, Germany, Austria, Norway, Greece, Sudan, and Haiti. Okay, so on to jobs. Trump claimed the US economy has gained a record 9 million jobs over the past 3 months. problem with that is that it does not account for that only came after a record loss of about 22.2 million jobs. So, you know, good for you, I guess, getting some of those jobs that were lost back. So, but the fact that he's touting that is just really ridiculous. Without acknowledging that the fact that those were jobs that were originally lost. So I won't take any credit for the jobs lost, but I will take credit for the jobs gained. Gotcha. Makes sense. Trump claimed that the Paycheck Protection Program for small businesses has saved or supported more than 50 million American jobs. A report from S&P Global found that the money saved about 13.6 million jobs. Well, it's still a good amount, but it's still not anywhere close to 50. Separately, a half a dozen economists interviewed by Reuters put the number of jobs saved between 1 and 14 million. Officials from the Small Business Administration, which oversees the program, said the claims about more than 50 million jobs refers to the total number of workers reported by businesses approved for loans, not the number of jobs that were saved. And yeah, a lot of those loans aren't big enough to support every single job. So there you go. I mean, it wasn't, you know, that program couldn't produce enough money to save 50 million jobs on its own. Trump claimed that the Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden has pledged a $4 trillion tax hike on almost all American families. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget estimates that Biden's tax plan would raise about $3.35 trillion to $3.6 trillion over a decade. The Biden tax plan is highly progressive, increases taxes for the top 1% earners of earners by 13 to 18% of after-tax income, while indirectly increasing taxes for most other groups by 0.2 to 0.6%. Here's another Trump quote. Last month, I took on Big Pharma. You think that's easy? It's not. And signed orders that will massively lower the cost of your prescription drugs. He also promised to further reduce the cost of prescription drugs. Now, the president signed four executive orders in July aimed at reducing drug prices, but it's far from clear whether they will ever take effect or greatly lower prices if they do. One known as the Favored Nations measure, which has not been released by the White House yet, generally calls for setting Medicare reimbursement levels for certain drugs on their cost in other countries. A second order calls for effectively banning drug makers from providing billions of dollars in rebates to pharmacy benefit managers and insurers, a radical change in the way many drugs are priced and paid for in Medicare and Medicaid. Instead, drug companies would be encouraged to pass the discounts directly to patients at the pharmacy counter. The administration had to back down from its effort last summer, in part because it would have likely raised Medicare premiums. Another executive order pushes allowing drug importation from Canada, where prices are much lower. It would also allow manufacturers to import lower-cost versions of the drugs they sell in other countries. The final order directs federally qualified health centers, which provide primary care services to underserved communities, to pass along discounts on insulin and EpiPens to their patients. It's likely the drug industry would take the administration to court if the president moves forward with the orders. Now, as for drug prices, GoodRx, which follows several thousand brands of brand name and generic medications, found that manufacturers hiked prices on 857 drugs by an average of 6.8% in the first 6 months of this year. That compares to 933 medications rising an average of 7% over the same time last year. So the increases have tailed off a little bit. According to their website, which provides cost comparisons and consumer discounts. The number of drugs and rate of price growth slowed between 2015 and 2019. So they're going in the right direction in that way. Another thing that he has said many, many times, and he said it again during his acceptance speech, he falsely claimed he passed the Veterans Choice Program. But the Veterans Choice Bill, a bipartisan initiative led by Senators Bernie Sanders and the late John McCain, was signed into law by President Barack Obama in 2014. What Trump is referring to is the VA Mission Act, which expanded and changed the choice program. Trump said, "We have already built 300 miles of border wall." And this is the last, I have a couple more here, actually. "We've already built 300 miles of border wall. As of August 7th, some 275 miles of barriers had been constructed on the U.S. border with Mexico. But just 5 of those miles were erected in places where no barriers had existed before. The remaining 245 were erected in place of old barriers, or the remainder, I should say, 245 were erected in place of old barriers, while 25 miles of new secondary wall were erected to fortify primary barriers." During a speech, Trump claimed that he has, quote, "very good information that China wants Biden to win because Biden cheers for China." While we don't know what information Trump may have, a recent assessment from the intelligence community, which we just talked about, reported that China referred Trump to lose the election because he was, quote, "unpredictable," and because of the many actions he has taken against China. Well, okay, well, I guess that's good that he's taken actions against China. Trump has claimed NATO members had agreed to pay for 130. Okay. Trump claimed NATO members had agreed to pay $130 billion more per year. NATO Secretary General Jan Stoltenberg explained during a meeting with Trump on December 3rd, 2019, that by the end of 2020, non-U.S. NATO members would have added a total of $130 billion to their defense budgets since 2016, not $130 billion per year. So it's $130 billion over 4 years, not over per year. So, got that. Okay. Referring to the U.S. Embassy, and I actually did catch this part of the speech, referring to the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem, Trump claimed it cost less than $500,000 to open. So rather than spending $1 billion on a new building as planned, Trump said he took an already owned existing building at a better location, real estate deal, right? And opened it at a cost of less than $500,000. The State Department awarded a $21.2 million contract in 2018 for a company to design and build compound security upgrades related to Trump's decision to turn the existing facility into an embassy. While the initial modification that allowed the building to open as an embassy cost just under $400,000, that was not the final total. Trump said that he, when demonstrators began tearing down statues and monuments, I signed an order immediately, 10 years in prison. Trump issued the order on June 26th that, among other things, directed the Attorney General to prioritize investigating and prosecuting certain cases of vandalism, especially of monuments and memorials of U.S. veterans, in accordance with, quote, applicable law, end of quote. One of the laws cited in the order is the destruction of government property, which carries the potential fine of up to $250,000, 10 years imprisonment, or both, if the purposeful damage to government property exceeds $100. The law has been around since 1964. Oops. Trump claimed Biden vowed to oppose school choice and to close all charter schools, ripping away the ladder of opportunity for Black and Hispanic children. We've talked about this on the show already. He doesn't want to ban charter schools. He just wanted to ban for-profit charter schools from receiving federal funding. And this is a big problem as to why education is even or the federal government is involved in education to begin with. Honestly, it should be a block grant. It should just be a block grant. If they're going to give money, make it a block grant. Each district gets X amount per person. Done. And let them spend it in the way they should spend it. The federal government should not be in education policy because it's such a regional thing. So I mean, when libertarians talk about, you know, the government being involved less, that's one of the areas I completely agree with that they should not be involved with. So there you go. There you go. And I didn't cover all of the lies that were told in Trump's speech and all the exaggerations. But you can just imagine that, you know, when he talks, you can't really believe much of what he says. And I hope anybody with a functioning brain should be able to see that by now. So, all right. It's been a long show, but we're going to push on.
Previously on Big Brother.
All right. So, when we last talked about this, Tyler had become the HOH. And he went with the nominations I thought he would, although there was a little bit of intrigue with Devon and her getting a little paranoid, and she wanted to be the plus one of Enzo, who ended up winning the safety suite competition. So he then picks Christmas for whatever reason. I don't know why. I guess because they weren't aligned yet, and he wanted to have her be in her good graces. But as we're going to talk about with the later shows, Devon probably is happy that she didn't get that. But Tyler did end up putting Janelle and Kaser on the block. No surprise there. But Devon is just playing too hard, I think. I think she's trying to play both sides. And it's going to, you can do that if you do it subtly. And you just, you know, actually, I think Danny's doing it. She's doing well, but she's got to be careful about that as well. But I think Devon's doing it a little bit too hard. And you got to be really, when you're going to do that, you can't be aggressive about it. And I think she's just being a little bit too over the top with that and playing both sides. I mean, the strategy makes sense and what she's trying to do. And I don't think she was on anybody's radar before that, but she's going to make herself a target if she keeps kind of being paranoid about it. And I think that's what I worry for her. So I'd like to see her go far in the game. Bailey was really trying to, you know, get on Team Janelle and maybe even possibly trying to flip to Janelle's side over the six person alliance she's in. That doesn't make any sense at all, because then all she's got is Kacer and Janelle on her side, and now her alliance is no longer trust her. Why are you going to go against the alliance that's a really strong alliance? So I don't know why she was even considering that. Again, Danny's doing really well, but she's got to be careful about getting, you know, playing with too many people. During the veto competition, I didn't realize that he had to match these cupcakes like a puzzle. And Kacer made the same mistake I would have made, which is he forgot the fact that the base had to also match the color of the cupcakes. So I missed that part as well. I didn't realize that was the case. I thought he had one and then he didn't. I like that the house thought that Mephis was trying to throw the competition to Janelle. But he said he was, you know, he said in the diary room that he was trying to, so I have no reason to not believe him. But he just did really bad, and actually it may have hurt his game. This comes after his HOH reign, which he did not execute very well, which I talked about last week. He didn't do a very good job as HOH. And I think he definitely moved himself to the bottom of his alliance. And then his performance against Janelle in the veto competition, even though he still ended up beating her, didn't do anything to help his case. Because they can now take what happened last week, combine that with this competition, and now it makes him look even worse. So he's going to be in some trouble, I think, going forward. I think that's going to help Kacer, who ended up surviving the block, as we're going to talk about. Then, of course, because Christmas was Enzo's plus one, she got this all-star baby punishment. So Devon probably should be happy that she didn't get that, because that seemed like it was a real pain in the butt. And again, I made a note. I was writing notes as I was watching this. Again, Bailey was just making a mistake, I think, by pushing too hard for Janelle to stay. And ultimately, she voted to evict her, but the vote was still 9-2. And, you know, Janelle was campaigning. Danny, she would never, you know, she was trying to convince Danny to vote for her, but she said she could never do that, which is interesting because of what happens later. I wrote down at this point that this is during the eviction show. So before the eviction, I said, if Janelle stays, it is 100% production, because there's no way that these players would be stupid enough to leave her there for any other reason. I think that if Kacer stays, which he ended up doing, I think he has a chance to stay around for a while. I think he'll be able to lay low. He's kind of by himself. And I think that people may be able to see him as an ally now that Janelle's out of the house. So they know that he needs support. He may be an easy target just to take out, have an easy week off, but because it wouldn't really make anybody upset. But I think that there's a chance to have him as an ally, and if he can win some competitions, then they can have him. But then David makes that rookie mistake, and this may have been the best thing to happen for Kacer, because now you have Tyler and Cody having David on their radar big time, because he basically gave him information. Tyler gave it, and Cody gave David information that he said, you cannot tell anybody, you especially can't tell Devon or Bailey this. And what does he do? He tells them. And he tells them under no pressure at all. He offered the information up. He just said, hey, by the way, Tyler told me that Devon was going to try to flip the vote on me. Wait, what? And it turned out that I can't remember if that was true or not, but I don't know. Anyway, now Tyler and Cody have them in their crosshairs, you know, have David in their crosshairs. And that's probably the best thing that could have happened for Kacer. So now they start the eviction vote, and Danny's first, and she votes to keep to Janelle. After all that, it even threw Julie off. And so at first, I'm watching this, I'm like, oh my God, they might actually flip the vote. Well, she ends up getting it voted out 9-2. Enzo, he likes to do those cute little things and throw out weird votes. But the fact that Danny is the second vote, I think, is going to throw a lot of people for a loop. And people are going to be wondering who that second vote, you know, who those two votes were. She's obviously going to be able to say that it's not her, because everyone knew she wanted Janelle out. So I think Danny is that was another brilliant move by Danny, because now it's going to create a little bit of chaos that she can just kind of lay low from, and no one's ever going to suspect her. So I thought that was actually ended up being a good move, throwing the house off by like that. Danny's playing a really good game so far, and they actually did a little vignette on that, and that was just another brilliant move by her. Lastly, Julie Chen, you know, says, you know, now that you're leaving the BB bubble, you have to put your mask on. It's like, dude, they're not going to be sick. Why are they one? Okay, first of all, they're sitting 10 feet apart. Secondly, Julie should be the one wearing a mask, not the contestant. Are you trying to protect the contestant? Are you trying to protect Julie? Because Julie Chen is out and about. The house guests are not. Wearing the mask doesn't protect yourself. It protects other people, remember? Do they not understand that, or do they just miss the memo, or is their wokeness just so on display that they don't even know why they're doing it? They're just doing it because they're told that they have to do it. It's like people don't understand. It's like, come on, what the hell is wrong with you guys? Oh man, that was just a kind of an aside. But anyway, last thing. And I promise this is it. I know this is a long show this week. So I'm going to give you my prediction on the election for president. Here's what I think is going to happen. Based on the numbers today and looking at what they were like 4 years ago, this time 4 years ago, and what I think the Trump campaign will do close to the election to throw off Joe Biden and throw off the Democrats with an October surprise, I think that Trump's going to pull it off again. It's going to be closer than it was last time. I think they're going to have it's going to be a bigger margin in the popular vote. I think that Michigan and Pennsylvania will flip, but the inaction in Wisconsin will lead to a narrow victory for Trump there. And if that happens, and I think that he'll hold Arizona and Florida, it'll be close, but I think he'll hold those. That would give him a 270 to 268 victory. So all Trump has to do is keep all the states that he did and win one of Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. That's all he needs. And he's got enough to win. So now here's another intriguing piece of the puzzle, okay? If Pennsylvania stays with Trump, but Michigan, Wisconsin, and Arizona flip, that will result in a tie, 269 to 269. Then, if one congressional seat in Florida and one seat in Pennsylvania flip to Democrats, each party would have a majority in 25 states, because each state gets one vote in the House, as we've talked about before. If the Senate goes 50-50, it's unknown whether the VP can vote in a tie in that situation. I think the way that the laws are written, he cannot break that tie. So you'd have a 25-25 tie in the House. You'd have a 50-50 tie in the Senate. Can you imagine? Could you even imagine that kind of crap happening? And man, I can't, I can only... That'd be a nightmare. That'd be a crisis beyond crisis. And I think that would lead to true chaos in this country more than we already are seeing now. That'd be the scariest thing. And I think it can happen. I think it can happen. And that's just unbelievably scary. But anyway, thank you for joining us on the Moderate Podcast this week. I'm finally done. I know I talked a lot this week, but I had to make it up for last week because last week was just kind of a crap show. So anyway, hopefully we didn't have any first-time listeners last week because I probably lost them. But anyway, remember to visit our website at themoderatepodcast.com. We are on Twitter at themodpodcast1. We are on Facebook at facebook.com/themoderatepodcast. And we are on YouTube at tinyurl.com/modpodcastyoutube. We are on Instagram at The Moderate Podcast. Check us out on all those if you wouldn't mind. Our Twitter account started taking off a little bit, getting more and more followers, so that's pretty cool. I've been more active on that lately. and getting into some trouble. Not trouble, but just stirring up conversation. And that's what we need to do is have more conversation in this country. But civil conversation, it just seems like it's a lost art form. We can't just have conversations with people that we don't necessarily agree with, but at least respect each other for our various opinions. Just because they're not like ours doesn't mean they're not smart people. There's smart people on both sides, all right? It's good to remember that. Anyway, we will see you next week, and until then, keep it real.